Mr. Pittman, Reel 2. We were talking about your time as a boy artificer on HMS Fitzcarrald at Chatham, 1934 onwards, and just looking at sort of the various things you do. What about kit inspections and preparing for kit inspections?
Yes, we used to have kit inspections, yes.
And how would you prepare for them, and how strict would they be?
Well, quite strict. You had to roll it all up on your bed, and the officer came around and inspected your kit. And you always said that you had one on, and one was in the wash. Oh, so you had three of everything. I beg your pardon. I said two. You had three of everything. One on, one in the wash, and one shown, right?
And any other routine things? What about weekends? Would you have church parades and things like that?
Oh, yes. Sunday, you had to go to church. You were marched to church on Sunday. Came to the garrison church at Chatham. And also, you through the week, you had one evening, you had religious instruction.
Was that? Did you have to go to that, or
yes?
And you still took an interest, although you weren't religious, or
I wasn't religious then. I was a devout Christian. It was only later on.
I think we'll move on to the next stage of your training now. So we got back to your fitting tests.
Yeah. Well, now for the last 2 years, it was. Turning, you went on a lathe, and you were terribly overtrained, really, because I know we one test job, you had to cut a four-start thread. Do you know what that is?
What was that?
Well, you know a screw thread goes down. Well, this is four different threads cut on the same thing, so that the nut travels four times as far at each turn. I even achieved once cutting a 16-star thread.
And what were the techniques of being a good lathe operator?
Well, often when you got to sea, it was before the days of everything being replaced by a spare. You often did have to make a piece. And I found in later life, even as an officer, I've turned somebody off the lathe and done my job myself because I remember.
But what makes you a good lathe operator? What were the skills you were trying to learn? Do you see what I mean?
Well, you had to use micrometers, but you weren't allowed to use micrometers until the later stages. Before then, you had to rely upon calipers, and you were expected to get within 2/1 of an inch with a pair of calipers, just by feel. And you cut threads and fitted one thing into another thing and all sorts of things. A lot of it was very good, but I say I never had a cut of multi-start thread again in my life. and then also, of course, you did milling. That was not milling, cutting gears and that sort of thing.
Is that a different machine?
Oh yes, that's a different machine. That's a mill. And also you did shaping. That was a sort of a plane that went back and forth like this. For planing down metal, and you also did boring on a big boring machine, grinding machines. You had to get terrific accuracy. We as mechanical fitters used to work to 1/1000th of an inch, but the electrical artificers had to work to 1/10 of an inch because they dealt with much finer stuff.
Did you find it difficult at that level? I mean, can you see that?
You can't see a thayer, no. You can measure it with a micrometer, though.
How did you use a micrometer? I mean,
Don't you do it? Oh, I haven't got mine now, it's in the workshop.
Can you just describe how it works?
Yes, it's a sort of U-shaped. And it's got a screw in one end, got an anvil this end, an anvil which travels on a screw, right? And it's divided, one turn is 1/40 of an inch, right? And the mark for one turn is divided into 25 parts. So that's 1/25 of a 1/40 of an inch, which is 1/1000 of an inch. And you screw it up until, you mustn't screw it too tight, but you're going to a misreading. Well, at the end, you've got a, most micrometers, you've got a ratchet, so you can actually feel when it's touching. And each division then is a 1/30 of an inch. So you read the mark on the part you turn against the fixed mark just to read how far it is.
And that how about calipers? How did they work?
Well, you get external calipers, which are bay leg calipers like that. And well, it's just that you slide it over to feel a fit. And then you get internal calipers, which are sort of shaped, I did kind of two legs like that, with a bit turned out that way. And that goes in, and then you get an internal micrometer where the barrel's in the middle and the ends go out like that. And you measure.
So, you were doing lots, during the second phase, you were working the lathe, the milling, shaping, boring and grinding, using micrometers and calipers. Not much to do with guns at this stage, ordnance.
We used to go to the gunnery school one evening a week to have a talk on guns by a chief gunner's mate.
And what were they covering?
Oh, 15-inch turrets mainly, and six-inch pedestal mountings and whatnot. And we also used to visit the Marshall Sort, which was a 15-inch monitor in the Chatham Dockyard.
And what were you being shown there again?
15-inch turret. It was quite impressive when you first saw one. You remember, a 15-inch gun weighs 90 tonnes. The turret weighs 900 tonnes. The shell weighs nearly a tonne, and that can travel 15 miles.
And could you sketch out for us the layout of a 15-inch gun turret?
Yes, certainly. You had two guns which elevated independent of one another, but of course had to train together because they were in the same turret. And then you had the gun house, and these enormous breeches, which used to be operated by hydraulics. And then below that you had the working chamber, and between the gun house and the working chamber you had the gun loading cage. This was a cage where the shell was put on the top shelf, the loads of cordite, which were big bags of cordite, were put on the bottom shelves, four bags. And then it was raised by hydraulics to the breech, but there was an interlock which made it impossible to raise it if the breech was closed. So the breech had to be open. So that came up in line with the breech, the top shelf first in line with the gun. The operator then used to put his lever back part of the way, and a hydraulic rammer used to come out and force the shell into the gun, and then he would pull the lever again, and the top the shelves on the top of the cage would open and drop the cordite down on in line, and that would then be rammed into the gun. Then the gun loading cage would be lowered and the breech closed, and the gun could then fire.
Now that sounds very similar to the operation of a 15-inch gun in 1916. Had it changed at all?
The only difference was the hood. The old 15-inch Mark I, that's what they were called, the flash-tight doors over the top of the gun loading cage, sorry, I forgot to mention the flash-tight doors, were up and down tights like this. But the hood had a big 3/4-inch radial doors.
We'll come back to the hood because I know you're going to go to the hood, so we'll save that in a sense. Mm. But had much been done to about flash since Jutland,
this is why, as I mentioned, the hood had these improved flash doors.
But why didn't you, did that? Was that not the case in all 15-inch gun turrets?
Well, no. What happened was, apparently. The flash tight doors were not all that good. They used to sometimes stick or jam or something onto the cage as it was going down. And another thing they did after Jutland was to fit covers to all hoist pipes. because boys' pipes had been open. And after that, you fitted covers, hinged covers, so you closed a boy's pipe when you weren't using it.
Any other flash precautions? Had they introduced things about not having round in the working chambers and things, no more ammunition out than they were intending to use? Because another problem that they found in Jutland was that there was ammunition
The ammunition was brought up from the shell room and the magazines to the working chamber by another hydraulic lift. And the shells were actually stored in this shell room, and the magazines, they were pretty flash tight. Yes.
Now, you were introduced to these guns, but were you given the opportunity to learn the gun drill of each job in the turret? Because there's lots of different jobs in the turret. I think we'll probably come to them when we get to the hood, but another. Were you learning gun drill, as it might be?
Well, no, not really, because we were more interested in the maintenance.
What aspects of maintenance were you looking at?
We used to have to strip the breeches down.
How would you do that?
Take it apart. And oil it and whatnot. And clean it. We used to have to strip the recoil systems down. Same to those. And, well, every machine we had to make, they all had regular intervals at which they had to be stripped and inspected. And we also had a lubrication routine.
And what lubricants would you use and where?
Well, the hydraulic medium, that was the liquid that was pushed around by the hydraulics, was a mixture of a vegetable oil and water. And oil, it was ordinary mineral oil. 30.
And so that's one. You were learning this maintenance program.
Well, yes, we were. Yes.
And what about cleaning the barrels? Was that part of the routine, or would?
It wasn't part of our routine. The barrels were cleaned by the crew because they used to pull them through.
What about?
I have known go through a 15-inch gun, pulled through on a canvas to inspect the rifling.
You've been through it yourself.
Well, Paul Horton had to go, and he had to go part of the way, but small people have been right the way through.
The rifling was important because as they fired, it wore down, didn't it?
Yes.
Would the Tiffy, the ordnance artificer, would they keep an eye on rifling, or was it done by a number of shells fired and then automatic replacement?
Yeah, the guns were inspected by the Naval Ordnance Department every so often.
So not by you, usually?
No, not unless we could see any obvious defects.
And anything else you were learning as ordnance artificers?
Well, I said there was drilling, milling, shaping. In the last 6 months, because we did 4.5 years, we were sent out to work on ships in the dockyard.
And what sort of jobs would you be doing there?
Oh, any job in the engine room. I've been in an engine room when it's been white with asbestos dust. And, any...
So not just as ordnance artificers, this is ERA work?
Oh, yes, anything, yes.
Mm. Artificer work?
Mm. Yes, anything, yeah. And then, at the end of that 6 months, you did your pass-out exams.
What do you remember of them?
Oh, that was engineering, technical drawing, mathematics, naval history. And you could, according to the way you passed out, you were given either no advancement, 6 months advancement, or 3 months advancement. I got 3 months advancement, which meant you were promoted to fourth class to TIPS 3 months early.
So you came out as a... Is that when you came out as a fourth class artificer?
No, you came out as a fifth class artificer, in which you wore one hook, you were a leading hand. And then you were sent to your various training depots, which for me, of course, is Whale Island.
Now, so when did you leave? Should be able to work it out from the
summer. July 1938.
And that's when you went to...
Whale Island.
Now, what was it? Is that the gunnery school, Whale Island?
Yes.
And what do you remember of your training there?
Well, again, your first training was pre-drill. And slightest error, you were made to double round the island or hop up and down the sloping bank with a rifle held above your head. The gunner's mates really didn't like how to...
There as well.
What I remember mainly about Whale Island, they had a very nice zoo there.
This drill was really harsh, was it?
Oh, yes. Well, I suppose it would be considered harsh these days, but we didn't consider it harsh in those days. It was quite normal, I mean.
And so that's there was a drill programme. What was the next thing they were training? I mean, what gunnery training did you get?
Oh, well, then we spent so long in the workshop. There was an artificer's workshop there. And we were used to have various lectures on different guns and whatnot at Whale Island.
And what sort of topic would you deal with? So
you would deal with gun mountings, sights and directors, or sights and directors, as Hector the instructor used to say, range finders. I always remember Bert Kelsey, he was an instructor on range finders. We knew that we used a coincidence range finder. And the Germans used a stereoscopic rangefinder, which you consider...
How did the coincidence... If you could just explain, how did the rangefinders work?
A rangefinder works that each end of the rangefinder sends out, or it picks up an image, but only a half of it is received each end. And you bring it together in the sight by moving the reflectors, or lenses inside. And when you bring it into coincidence, then you read what the range is. Because what's actually is measuring the parallax angle.
So it's a mathematical process that the machine was doing for you.
That's right, yes.
And what was the difference between the German, was it stereo?
Stereoscopic range.
Stereoscopic range. And how did that work?
Well, that worked because they looked at the image, and they used to see the whole image, but they had marks in the rangefinder which they used to judge its distance from. They were actually looking at it in depth.
And which was better?
Well, Bert Kelsey used to swear the Germans were. I think they probably were too. But their range takers were properly trained for stereoscopic rangefinders and used to carry their own lenses with them to bring their eyes up to the standard.
So their eyes would be corrected so that there was no... In other words, they'd like a pair of glasses almost.
That's right, yes.
Bring their eyes up to 20/20 or whatever. Mm. And why do you think they didn't bring that system in the British Navy, the Royal Navy? Or
I've no idea.
Now, what else would you learn? You mentioned the rangefinders.
Rangefinders, sights and directors.
What were the sights?
That was the telescopic sights on guns, and also the sights in the directors. You had the loft director up the top, and you had the armoured director, which was further down.
So, was there anything in particular about telescopic sights you were learning?
Well, you had to learn how to maintain binoculars and telescopes. In fact, I always remember when I was... on one ship, the doctor said to me, "Ian, will you ever look at my glasses?" I said, "What's wrong with them?" So I looked at him, I said, "Well, you've got distortion." I said, "Yeah, hold on a minute, aren't you an ophthalmic specialist?" Oh, that was a long time ago.
Now, what about the directors? Could you explain what the system was? Because there'd been trouble about that in the First World War, about pollen and different systems that were used. What system of directive firing were they using, and how far into it were you expected to go as a ordnance?
Oh, the whole maintenance, the whole thing.
What system was being used? Could you explain? Did it have a name?
Yes, it did, but it's just escaped my...
How did it work anyway? Well, perhaps
you had two telescopes, right? And a rangefinder. And you had operators peering through them. And when they got on the target, they would call target. And the gunner officer would direct the fire.
And how did it work? How did that get through to the guns? Do you see what I mean?
Oh, Cause earphones. But the guns the operator used to have on earphones. I used to be I see what you mean, yes. I'm sorry. Oh, well, they used to have instruments.
I guess, I mean on a big 15-inch gun sort of ship, how did what I mean by director is the whole director system, because it did go to a transmitting station, the First World War, things that...
In those days, of course, what would be known as a computer now, it was purely mechanical. And we had such things as what we used to call the potter's wheel.
What was that?
That was a ring disc which revolved, and a ball which travelled across it. And this ball travelled across it, was moved according to the range of the enemy. And the disc was moving at a constant speed, and that used to work out the rate of change of speed of the enemy. And you had what was known as present range and future range, which was the range which was calculated to be the range that the enemy would be at when the fall of shot occurred. So you had to take into account time of fall of shot and all sorts of things. It was marvellous, really. You had the potter's wheel, which later on was known as the integrator, given a posh name. You had differentials, which were adding machines. These were gears which turned at speeds. And you had triangles, which used to be like a triangle of forces, which you used to put in two vectors and it would work out the third vector. All sorts of wonderful gadgets.
Where was all this?
The transmitting station was well below decks. And it was normally manned by the bandsmen. Marine bandsmen. And always stationed in the transmitting station would be the warrant ordnance officer and the chief ordnance artificer.
So the ranges would come down to this?
To this. This would then take the ranges being read, the speed of the enemy, your own speed which you knew, and the estimated speed of the enemy, that is, which the gunnery officer had estimated, and angle of sight, bearing, and this would all be worked out.
And then what would happen? So that's all done on these machines.
That's
transmitted.
Right.
And then what's the product of that?
The product of that is future range and bearing, which would then be transmitted to the gun positions.
Mechanically or...?
Electrically. And that would be registered on the dials on the instruments of the guns.
And then would they set to that automatically, or would that then become manual?
No, small gun mountings were operated manually, but 15-inch, of course, are hydraulic.
So you'd set the thing for the rate. The
well, yes, you'd just move a lever and the thing would move until you read what you wanted.
And then you'd be ready to fire. Now, how far into this rather complicated, it was a computerised in the old sense of the word, not electrical, but how far into this would you go as a tiffy?
Oh, I could strip the fire control table down and put it back together again. Fence I did once when I was officer. I did it on a cruiser in the Mediterranean because the TS got flooded. And they thought the transmitting table was lost because by that time the ordnance engineer was straight from college, engineering college. He'd done no sort of rating training at all. And then I was assistant fleet ordnance engineer in the Mediterranean.
I will come back to this. This transmitting table was where all these machines were. Were that they right. made up the...
Yeah, they were all put together and they all joined up with differentials and that sort of thing and added this to that. And
did they still have the plotting thing where they had the different coloured inks, or had that been replaced by mechanical means?
Yeah, there was a plot as well, yes.
Mm. And that was in there as well?
Yes. Mm.
So you learned that. That's a rather complicated topic, I would imagine.
Oh, yes, yes.
And anything else that you were learning at
Royal Well, yes. Well, when you joined a ship, you were either detailed officers.
Sorry, we're still on Whale Island. Anything else you were learning at Whale Island?
Well, as I said, in the last 6 months, you did more or less general engineering, anything. Sorry, Whale Island. Yeah, I'm big.
It's all right.
My memory's gone back too far. Well, no, I suppose it was an intensive 6 months course, you know.
Did they actually take you through something like 6-inch gun drill, or was that just irrelevant to
no,
you?
No, we didn't do drill, no.
So you were just learning these rather...
That's right, mm.
So that was 6 months, that would be from July 38 through to...
December.
December.
And in January I joined the foot.
Now, was there an examination or passing out at Whale Island?
Oh yes, yes.
How were you tested?
Again, in all the subjects that you've done.
A proper full-scale examination?
Oh yes.
And
Most of it was verbal though. You were examined by gunnery officers.
And what sort of thing would they ask?
Well, anything. They'd ask you to describe how this worked, how this worked. Yeah, they could give you a pretty good quiz.
And what difference? I mean, did everybody pass, or were people failed? And what happened? Because you'd had 3 months advancement from the last course, you know. Well,
you could lose your advancement if you didn't do well enough.
But you didn't.
No, I didn't do that.